Welcome back, everybody. This is Eric and Matt, and this is Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit, your beacon of freedom and the American way of life. Tune in every Friday for a new episode as we dive into the world of liberty and what makes our country great. All right, guys, I hope you've all had a great week. Welcome back. And we have another LLP episode here for you today. And boy, is this one a doozy.
It is.
All right, we're going to be talking about the AK-47 versus the AR-15. Now, here's the thing, or M16, what have you. This is an argument that is probably as old as time, or at least as old as those guns have been around. And I can't tell you how many times I've seen people make these comparisons between these two guns, whether it's by proxy of the conflicts they were involved in, the side of the world they originated on, the type of people that used each of the guns. I mean, we're going to go into some history in today's podcast. But even in today's world, I mean, here in the U.S., I mean, the AK-47 and the AR-15, very, very prevalent guns in terms of an overall design. So as a result, they each have their own little cult following of people that really go after each one and swear by each one. We're going to break down the pros and cons of each gun. There are some pros and cons.
Most definitely there is.
And we'll just dive into this and see whose feelings we can hurt. Before we get started with today's podcast, I'd like to thank our friends at My Patriot Supply for supporting LLP. In the coming years, things are going to be getting really crazy. Are you ready? Do you have a plan in case of food shortages, power outages, emergency evacuations? You should always prepare before these things strike. That's why we recommend getting your emergency food from My Patriot Supply. They're America's number one preparedness company with several million happy, well-prepared customers. Their food lasts up to 25 years in storage. It's like a survival insurance policy that you can eat. When you need it, it will be there. Right now, you'll save $100 on a 3 months emergency food kit from My Patriot Supply. Go to the link below or go to www.mypatriotsupply.com/LLP. You'll receive a $100 discount off a 3 month emergency food kit from My Patriot Supply. Check them out and tell them we sent you.
You know, I like both weapons systems or both platforms. I think they're both very unique. But, you know, me knowing the manual of arms for M16 or AR-15 rifle, it makes it a lot easier for me. Takedown, you know, cleaning, maintenance, and even just handling the firearm itself. The AK, whether it, you know, whatever platform, there's like, and that's another thing, guys. There's so many platforms for that AK variant. Like, you just have so many. AR-15 is pretty much the same, regardless. It's the same system, but all the parts are interchangeable. Try that with an AK. It's like, it doesn't work. Like, doesn't fit.
There really does seem to be some definite odd things going on with each gun. I mean, the AR-15, arguably, and honestly, you know, this is the case, is adult Legos. I mean, you can totally take the AR, and there's so many different barrel lengths and gas systems and different gas system types. I mean, there are piston ARs now, in addition to direct gas impingement. So we're going to go into a couple of terms and a few technical specs on the guns just to try to bring people up to speed. I know this is an old argument that's been posed many, many times, but it's always fun to kind of rehash it, because as technology changes, as better platforms are out there, I mean, the AK as a platform, to be fair, you know, has gone through some considerable upgrades. I mean, when you look at the AK-12 and the newer stuff that's coming out of Russia now, we can't get that here, of course.
Right.
But the platform as it exists has gone through many, many revisions that have brought it up to speed reasonably so. We're going to try to somewhat go after this in a methodical manner. It's probably best to just sort of start at the beginning, I think, is the best way to look at this entire situation. And let's go back and look at the inventors of both of these guns a little bit and talk about the history and how they came to be and the people that came, you know, to invent these particular guns. And I guess we'll go, let's just go in chronological order and start with Mikhail Kalashnikov. Okay.
Mikhail.
Okay. So obviously the person that the gun is named after, I mean, the Kalashnikov is named after Mikhail Kalashnikov, because he's the gentleman that designed it. Now, without boring people to tears and getting into every little tiny technical detail, Kalashnikov was a tank commander during World War II. He was injured in a tank battle or whatever, and he wound up developing this rifle design while he was recovering in the hospital, whatever. And he his whole idea for designing this gun was to create an intermediate select fire infantry rifle. It could be mass produced, could be made cheaply, and fired an intermediate cartridge, and was and allowed the soldier to carry more ammunition and to get on the battlefield and lay down suppressive fire in a much, you know, better way and more accurate way. So to increase the standoff distance of the PPSH, which arguably is one fantastic machine gun.
That gun is absolutely amazing.
The PPSH was a great machine gun, and it served the Russians well in World War II and continued to be used in later conflicts all around the world in many other skirmishes, all the way up into like Vietnam and even later. I mean, there's PPSHs still out there being used all over the world, even now, in skirmishes all over the planet.
Yep.
So the gun is proven, but a really, really fast rate of fire, sometimes maybe a little bit difficult to control, not quite as accurate or precise for single shots, although they could be used for that capability quite well by experienced, you know, people, experienced operators. But the 7.62x25, for all of its merits, a few of the flaws that it represented for its use is that you had this Mosin-Nagant rifle firing a 7.62x54 rimmed. And doing that, you know, that's a full power rifle cartridge. And then to compare that to 7.62x25, not really much of an intermediate in between those two. You've either got really long range and lots of power and a five-shot turn bolt gun or an SVT 40 or something.
Right.
Or you've got the PPSH. There's not really anything in between. So I think Mikhail sort of saw a void that needed to be filled, especially after the Germans were fielding stuff like the MP44, the Sturmgewehr. That opened up everyone's eyes.
That was a game changer. Like, they really got out there on the battlefield with that thing, and even the Americans were kind of like, what is this? Like, it's a monster, man.
Yeah.
But I think it's a tale as old as time. You know, everybody that looks at this, you know, battle and like, oh, the AR versus the AK. And I mean, in respect to Mikhail Kalashnikov, when you look at Stoner, Eugene Stoner, he didn't have this epiphany of, you know, oh, I'm going to create this out of a, you know, a need for it like Kalashnikov did. He was just answering a call to a RFQ that the military put out that we need a rifle that shoots semi-automatic in 22 caliber. Like, that was it. Like, that was the reason it was invented. If that RFQ had never been put out there, then that rifle would have never been invented.
Well, and to be completely fair as well, you know, it's a completely different mindset to look at, like, let's just say full-blown communism back during Mikhail's time and when he developed the gun versus, you know, Eugene Stoner, obviously, you know, he's a capitalist. I mean, he's going to try to make money and get military contracts. But we'll get into Eugene Stoner's story a little bit. But it is interesting. I mean, imagine being on the battlefield and being the first person to encounter someone armed with a Sturmgewehr.
Yeah.
All right, so think about the way the Russians probably felt. They're like, wait a minute. You know, wow, this is such an idea. So there are some people out there, and I'm not going to get into the minutiae of who and exact situations, but I've just heard through the grapevine over the years that there are some people that think that Mikhail Kalashnikov ripped the concept off from the Sturmgewehr and sort of stole that and integrated it into the AK-47. Now, I mean, obviously, sure, I'm sure that played some design aspect into, you know, how he came up with the idea.
Yeah.
Surely he saw what the Germans were fielding, what they were developing, and arguably the Germans were on the forefront of small arms development.
And
development. Rocket development. Yeah, everything.
Yeah, they were, I mean, they were in a position where they had nothing to lose. Like, they were throwing everything at the wall and seeing what stuck. And, you know, they had great ideas. A lot of it stuck. And what didn't stick at the time kind of got recycled into, you know, everybody else. Like, their rocket program got absorbed into the U.S. with when we exported a whole bunch of their scientists over here down in Alabama, which was the rocket program. But, you know, along with that, you had the, you know, any type of small arms, rockets. You had all kinds of stuff. The jet engine technology that came out of Germany at the time that didn't really take off, but it got absorbed into a lot of other countries. So to say that, oh, so-and-so ripped off this, you know, idea. Well, the idea doesn't really belong to anybody anymore at the time. They lost the war. It's kind of like vapor. It gets lost in the ether. Nobody owns that anymore. It was designed for a purpose for a military that no longer exists. So then what?
Well, and to be fair, something that the Soviets and mm-hmm. the Chinese and, you know, any of the communist bloc countries, something they were really good at doing at the time, and to their credit, right, is to take a good design, something that works, and make it their own in a way that's unique and that is very utilitarian and cheap to manufacture. I mean, look at the TT-33 service pistol, the Tokarev. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of design elements where you think, oh, that's got some 1911 looking features to it. That's got some Browning influence in there. So they were smart enough to go, this is a good handgun.
Yeah.
Right. We're going to take this and roll with it. Right. So they're not wrong to take a good design. I mean, that's what you would do. Right. I mean, and even us Americans, we did the same thing. Right. Mm-hmm. How did we come to have the Bradley or not the Bradley, the Abrams tank? Right.
Yeah.
We took a lot of ideas from the advanced German tech from World War II. When the war was over, like, holy crap, mm-hmm. here we go. And we took some of those design elements and we made our tanks in their image, right? You know, or at least took some of those elements. So there's nothing wrong with taking a little inspiration, right? I mean, there was some inspiration taken from the M1 Garand to put in the AK-47.
Yeah.
So Mikhail Kalashnikov was credited as saying at one point, I'm not going to quote him exactly to the letter because I don't have every little bit in front of me, but he loosely, what he said is he wanted to create a machine with a very, very simple amount of movement and a very distinctive and direct operation. A machine with a very simple operation, right? Well, what is a machine? It has a piston, right?
Yep.
The gases impart, you know, he was a tank commander, so he understood how tanks worked and everything. So he developed this piston that would take the gas forces against the piston and drive the carrier to the rear, a machine with one very simple task, right? So the AK-47 is obviously, at this point, well-proven. I mean, it's been around forever. It was adopted in 1947. That's how it gets its model designation. And Mikhail Kalashnikov, literally, he's the reason that it exists. And the basic design parameters of the gun, sure, later on, you know, so the early guns had milled receivers and things like that, mm-hmm. you know, great guns, but probably a little harder to manufacture once they started making them with stamp receivers to speed up the operation. Loosen many the would tolerances. Say the milled, obviously a little more robust, mm-hmm. stronger, a little more rigid, probably, you know, a little heavier duty than a stamp receiver. But then with the stampings, they saved a little bit of weight. They were able to manufacture them cheaper.
Yeah, and I think that's what it comes down to is you do still see some milled receivers out there. I've seen some with like the Spetsnaz guys. They're not using your standard like everyday AK bodies. They're getting some special gear, just like our tier one guys would be getting, you know, specialized stuff made specifically for them. The newer AKs look really modern. You're used to that classic look with, you know, wood furniture or the skeleton stock, and everything is stamped. You can tell it's just a sloppy gun. Like that, there's tolerances are not exact, and that's what you've just come to expect from an AK. That's what makes it an AK. But when you see like the newer stuff, you're like, wow, this stuff looks high speed. Like they have like faux buffer tubes, because obviously there's no buffer in it, but they're using the buffer tube to hold the stock so it gets like a more modern like M4 style stock. It looks cooler.
That's right.
And looking cool is half of the battle. I mean, if you're gonna die, you better die looking cool. Like that's what it is.
Well, you know, there is the increased functionality. Like, so mm-hmm. with some of the modern AKs that are out there, I mean, obviously, you know, you have folding stocks and collapsible stocks and yeah. rail systems to account for flashlights and accessories and other high speed gear, just like someone would put on an AR, which we're going to get to that in a minute. But also, you know, really, like when they developed the 74 mm-hmm. and got that, you know, 5.45x39 in the AK, I think that's when the AK really, really had a huge moment where it went from being just a spray and pray, you know, close in infantry weapon that you could just issue to a peasant to, mm-hmm. hey, now a guy can get behind this thing and actually do some decent work if he knows what he's doing. And we see that with the wars in Afghanistan, with the Soviets. I mean, they did some pretty good work with the 74s, and, you know, to the point that the Mujahideen actually wound up considering the 5.45 the poison bullet.
Yeah, because it was like the velocity on it, the mm-hmm. accuracy on it was a little bit better.
So 5.45, and obviously now you've got AKs that are chambered in 5.56, mm-hmm. you know, and that's to compete with their NATO counterparts. We'll get into that a little bit as we go. Let's talk a little bit about Eugene Stoner. So Eugene Stoner started developing what would become the AR-15/M16 pretty early on. Around 1954 is when he developed the AR-10.
Yep.
And you know the AR-10 ended up being in the full battle rifle caliber in 7.62 by 50-51.
Yep.
So what's kind of cool about that is he really did cross some very interesting territory, Eugene Stoner did. And he took some ideas, just like Kalashnikov did. He took some ideas from some earlier rifles and integrated it into his rifle. So it's not like the AR-15 just appeared in Eugene Stoner's mind overnight. As you know, he wasn't the first person to take gas and dump it back into the action and have a mm-hmm. direct gas impingement gun. That concept has been, you know, done over the years. The French did it with the MAS rifles, you know, the semi-auto MASs. Hakim and the AG-42. So the Swedish, actually right here, the Swedes had the AG-42 service rifle. And the 42, it has a gas tube that goes right back against the bolt face into a cup. So right there, you've got sort of the inklings of what would become the AR-15 right there. So he did take some concepts that were already mm-hmm. out there a little bit. You look at the Swiss K-31, right? Straight pull, bolt action rifle. What do you have? A cam slot cut into a bolt. The bolt rotates as you impart a rearward pull.
Yep.
It imparts a rotational axis on the bolt, which for the time was, you know, you're talking 1931 technology, right? So you're talking that sort of basic camming action like you saw on the bolt of the AR-15 was around in the 30s in Switzerland. The Swedes in the 40s already had direct gas impingement. The mm-hmm. French were using it. So it's not like it was necessarily new per se, but he put those components together in a way that was so special and so unique that he really did pave the way for what we see as modern rifles today. I mean, using aircraft grade aluminum yep. and modern manufacturing techniques and polymers and injection molding. Well, maybe not then. I believe it was like Bakelite, which yep. I guess is sort of a forming technique of taking these, you know, almost like different types of stuff and making a form or whatever, a mold. It's still correct. Kind of the same type of concept. But all of the modern manufacturing techniques of the West, or capitalism, if you will, in this case, if we're comparing the AK to the AR, really did take people off guard a little bit. They're like, what the heck is this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was more or less just, it was at the time, it was, you know, out of what people could imagine a weapon would be. They're used to, again, wood furniture, heavy, big rifles. And this was such a big, you know, move in the opposite direction. The idea was to make it as light as possible, you know, not necessarily a mass production weapon, like, you know, using stamped steel or, you know, stamped aluminum, but it was just so completely different than what people were used to. They were used to using M14s. They were used to using, you know, M60s, like just these big machine guns. And I'm kind of jumping ahead to Vietnam, but that's really when it was more prolific. But to think that they are holding something that's, in their mind, plastic versus wood, and the barrels are pencil barrels. They're used to these big, heavy barrels. So to them, they're holding it. They're like, oh, this feels cheap. You know, it's 22 caliber for all intents and purposes.
Yeah.
So, and then they're comparing it to what? The AK, which is what more traditional. They look at the AK
yeah.
and they have FOMO. You know, they're like, oh, that's what we want. We want the wood. We want, you know, the heaviness. We want, you know, the big, larger calibers, like the yeah. man's
bayonet yes. on it. You know,
that's what they're looking for. And they got the M16. So
I mean, you know, you're in Vietnam and you're issued an M16 for the first time and you see Mattel logo on the stock.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
A toy company's logo on the stock. That doesn't instill a lot of confidence. Yep. Now, the early M16s were plagued with a lot of issues, namely the powders they were using. The ball powders they were using fouled really, really, really bad.
Mm-hmm.
And they were causing the guns to malfunction like crazy. And because they rushed the guns into the field and they didn't really issue the proper cleaning implements early on, soldiers weren't keeping them very clean. And, of course, they choked left and right, didn't run worth a crap.
With the humidity up high.
Yeah, and they had some issues with the early barrel twist rates. Weren't stabilizing bullets really well. So, of course, they weren't very accurate. You combine that with the bad ball powders they were using early on that were really dirty. And they didn't get a very good reputation early on. But before we get to the M16, it's worth noting, I don't want to get completely down this rabbit hole, but it's worth noting that Eugene Stoner developed a lot of really awesome guns that a lot of people don't really give him credit for. So did Mikhail Kalashnikov. He did design an early subgun, and it didn't take off that well. But to be fair, you know, both of the gun designers had their fair share of really cool designs. Now, I think that Eugene Stoner probably wins a few points over Mikhail Kalashnikov because he did develop some really cool stuff. The Stoner 63 gets an honorable mention, which is argued. I mean, the Navy SEALs used those in Vietnam.
They did, yeah.
And the Stoner 63 now was probably one of the first truly modular type of rifles. I mean, it could be configured in a Bren configuration with a top-loading mag. You had a bottom-loading mag. It could be configured to a belt-fed, different barrel lengths. So already the gears were turning in Eugene Stoner's mind in terms of what would a modern infantryman need in terms of modularity.
Yeah.
And the Stoner 63s fared very well in combat. The Navy SEALs loved them. Yeah,
the UDT guys at the time.
Yeah, they were out there in blue jeans and Tiger Stripe camo, and they were doing good work with those things. So, all right, it's also worth noting that, you know, what they call the exact designation. So you had the AR-10, but there was also that little survival rifle, the AR-7.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? With the little plastic stock, and it folds up into itself. It floats if you throw it in the water. So it's like a survival gun. That was also one of Eugene Stoner's designs.
I think he modeled that for like pilots and stuff like that. So if they had to like ditch out in the water, they would have something there that would float and all that good stuff. So very unique. And that was kind of at the when ingenuity and manufacturing was kind of, you know, at its peak. You know, there's a lot of different, you know, crazy ideas at the time would seem like they're crazy ideas. But I think that the Vietnam War was pretty much the biggest showdown to date of what this podcast is revolving around, is like the AR or M16 versus the AK, because this was like the biggest showdown. It was a pretty long war. I want to say probably about, 6 years, 7 years. I mean, technically a little bit longer than that, but the actual ground combat was about 6 or 7 years.
That's right. So what would become, you know, the Armalite AR-15. So AR-15 stands for Armalite Rifle.
Armalite, yep.
Right, so Armalite Rifle Model 15 is basically a scaled down version of the AR-10. And of course, we know from history that it gone through a considerable amount of changes, you know, going from like the upper charging handle style of operation, like in the early 601s, to what we would see end up getting fielded in Vietnam. What we associate as the early M16, most of us, is the triangle fore end, the three-prong flash hider,
the fixed carry handle,
pencil barrel. I mean, it's an M16, and that's what most of us think about, is that triangle handguard. So yeah, so we're getting into the Vietnam War, and this is the first time the two rifles really go toe-to-toe.
Yep.
Literally, this is a battle of the two guns, literally against each other. 7.62x39 AKs versus the M16. Here we go.
Yep.
And we already discussed some of the initial issues that the early M16 had in Nam with the ball powders and the lack of cleaning kits, not to mention lack of training. Okay, the soldiers were quickly fielded, and there were many situations where soldiers would use an M14 in basic training and then show up to Nam and be handed an M16.
That's right.
So there's some training deficiencies that were clearly there. And I believe there was some political stuff going on too.
Oh, yeah. There was money changing hands. Like, yeah. There was definitely money involved. And I mean, to think of something like that happening now where you train and you get proficient on one weapon system and then you get into the actual battle space and they're like, oh, yeah, by the way, here is a completely different weapon, different manual of arms, different ammunition, different everything.
Yeah, and by the way, here's experimental ammo, yeah. And oh, we don't have enough cleaning kits to go around.
No cleaning kits.
Yeah, tie your boot laces up.
And well, they were being told it was self-cleaning, that you know, when you shoot it, it cleans. And I'm like, this is insane. This is nuts.
Yeah, it's kind of strange, isn't it?
Yep.
So at this point, you know, in the jungle environment, the M16, once they got some of the potential issues worked out later in the war, it started to come into its own a little bit better. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there were soldiers that were discarding M16s or turning back in to try to find M14s.
Yep.
So the M14 was still used by many, many soldiers, and some of them opted, especially early in war, they're like, screw this, give me an M14.
Or they're just picking up AKs off the ground. You know, a lot of guys were just picking up, because I mean, they were at that point more reliable, because it wasn't that they were inherently more reliable. It was that, you know, they were a much more simple system to use. And mm-hmm. let's just face it, it is a little bit of a more simple system to manipulate. Not clean or disassemble, but manipulate.
Well, there's another interesting factor, too, that we can kind of talk about. And I think this gets into some of the merits and flaws of the two guns as well. So you also think that you're in a jungle environment, close-in combat in some situations. Now, some of the combat was over, you know, long distances and ambush situations. But in situations where you're on patrol and you're in a close-in jungle environment and you might have a little run of woods that's only 50, 60 yards, the AK is the perfect weapon for that for a couple of reasons. One, it's very easy, simple to maneuver, which one could, argue that both rifles are completely able to be maneuvered. The AK-47 is probably a little shorter overall. And also, the 7.62x39 cartridge does much better in the bush.
It does.
The 5.56, I don't think soldiers realized at the time, and maybe even the military didn't realize, that when that little fast 55-grain bullet hits a little piece of brush, it's just going to fly off into the blue wonder. Yeah. The 7.62 would as well, but not nearly as bad. And because of its slightly slower velocity than the M14, you found that 7.62x39 got through that brush a little bit better in that in-close fighting in the jungle. So the 7.62x39 and the AK was just a better jungle fighting gun.
Well, it also had 10 additional rounds per magazine because the GIs at that time were issued 20-round mags, not 30-round mags. So 10s and 20s, and then you had the AK that had 30.
Yeah.
So they were outgunned from the beginning.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. You know, and it's not to say that the AKs were not without their potential issues. AKs are great guns. Now, let's just get past Vietnam and just mm-hmm. really now, I think now that people have a little bit of a background in terms of these two guns, their designers, some of the overall intended purposes of each gun, who they were built for, who used them in the early wars, without getting too much into the Vietnam War and getting down that rabbit hole, we'll probably mention a few things about it later in the podcast. Let's just get down now to the two designs as a whole, holistically, and sort of break apart some of the things we like and we don't like about each one. All right, and since we went chronologically to discuss the designers, let's go ahead and do the AK first.
Okay.
Since we discussed it first with Mikhail Kalashnikov. So early on, I think one distinctive characteristic to pay attention to with the AK, especially compared to the AR-15 or the M16, or let's just say the Stoner series, yeah. Whether it's AR-10, AR-15,
yeah,
any of the Stoner series, DI guns, what have you, all right, is that the AK certainly was intended to be a manufactured gun. It was meant to be put on a line and built in big batches by unskilled labor using the cheapest materials possible and to try to cut every corner they could to make it as cheap as they could mm-hmm. and to issue it to the maximum amount of people possible. You know, if you mess up something on an AK, let's say you get a bore obstruction in the barrel and you goose egg the barrel or blow the barrel off the gun or something, it's not easy to rebarrel that gun. It's not a gun that lends itself well to, I don't like this barrel length. I think I want the barrel shorter. Tough tough crap, comrade. That's your gun, right?
Yep.
Or, you know, the soldier goes back to the supply guy, gun no work. All right, and they go, here, replacement rifle. And they take that gun and just throw it in for parts. It's like it was meant to be used to the extent of its service life and then discarded and reissued. It wasn't meant – I just don't think they looked at it as a long-term, you know, oh, we're going to, you know, rebarrel this thing and keep it in service. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. Look at all the AKs that are out there that we're talking old Type 1 and Type 2 milled receiver AKs that are still – out there today doing their job and being used. Now they're shot out, they're raggedy, they need springs, but they keep using them.
And if you look at some of the, and I'm glad you brought that up, if you look at some of just the old world areas that have like just like dirt floor countries, the way that they service these AKs, like the ingenuity that goes into it and that they still work is a testament to the actual platform itself. So, I mean, you've seen some crazy stuff like coat hangers, holding stuff in, gum, you know, bubble gum wrappers, toothpicks, wood shims. I mean, it's like you open up that dust cover and you just never know what's going to be inside. If you're in like the mountains of Afghanistan, and you're like, holy crap, this thing is like being held together with like wood glue and a spring from a Bic lighter, but it works, you know? So
I think where the AK does win some points, let's not say over the M16, but just as a design, it is rugged. It does hold up very, very well. It's very simple to use, therefore very simple to train, you know, conscripts on how to use it. So from a military standpoint, it's a great military rifle.
Yeah,
because it has a very simple function. It's like, hey, you know, here's the mag. Here's how to load it. Pull this back. Here's your safety. You squeeze this trigger. I mean, that's it. Here's the sights. Line these things up. I mean, you could train someone on how to use it in no time. Where arguably, one could say that the Stoner series of guns requires a little bit more precise manual of arms, maybe a little bit more care to keep them clean, and a much greater need for maintenance, right? Yep. You know, they do need to be maintained. And to be fair, the manual of arms in terms of disassembly and field stripping and cleaning on the AR is certainly more difficult than the AK. A lot of smaller parts, a lot of things that can go wrong.
If you break it, well, I think if you break it down to not removing anything off of the bolt, then I think it's not that bad. But I think once you start pulling out cotter pins and stuff like that, it can be. But if you just look for like apples to apples, dust cover off the AK, you shotgun the AR, and you just pull the bolt out and the carry handle, that's pretty much it. You pull out the bolt carrier group, one piece, pull out the carry handle, that's another piece, and clean it.
Yeah, you can at least clean the bore and scrub the chamber.
Which resolves
you could maybe take some carb cleaner or some type of gun scrubber and just scrub the bolt out without disassembly. If you had to, you probably could.
But I mean, if you just think of it from that aspect, how often, let's just say, for example, how often in a battlefield scenario are you disassembling the bolt carrier group? You know, like it's probably not something you're going to do. You have gloves on. You know, you're not trying to like break it down and to find the issue. You're just scrubbing the carbon off the bolt, throw the bolt back in there. Boom.
That's right.
Good to go.
Now, that's a great way to segue into the AR a little bit. So there are some pros and cons of both guns. Arguably, I would say the 5.56 round is certainly head over heels way superior to the 7.62x39 in terms of long-range engagement.
Oh, yeah. And accuracy.
Yes. More accurate, better inherent accuracy potential. We know that because the AR, obviously, as a class of gun now, is used in long-range competition. It's been wildcatted and modded to the gills, whereby now there's people building lots of high-end AKs as well that have all, you know, there's 6.5 Grendel AKs and 5.56 AKs. I mean, not to say that the AKs don't have their cool guy stuff too, but the AR certainly lends itself more for that purpose. And many would say that the AR and its DI configuration is certainly a smoother recoil impulse and much better inherent accuracy potential. One thing about the AK, where it suffers in the accuracy department, is the way that the handguards are mounted to the system. Yes. All of the brackets that are pinned onto the barrel. So they take the barrel and they machine all the cuts in it that they need to have. They turn the cuts in it in order to have those shoulders where everything sits on it. And then those items have to be pressed on there, and then they're drilled through and they're pinned. So from a harmonic standpoint on the barrel, it does provide a little bit of an issue, right? Because now you're disrupting the harmonic signature of the barrel. You're getting bad barrel harmonics because you're not getting a free-floated barrel, and the barrels whip around a little bit. They're not super rigid. Some of the AKs have very light barrels, so as they heat up, they whip around like crazy, and they tend to really string badly at distance. And you combine that with the fact that you don't have very good distance with the 7.62x39 compared to the 5.56, then the 5.56 quickly begins to outclass the AK by a considerable margin in terms of distance. Now, close-in fighting, the guns are pretty well neck-to-neck, especially if it's not some really long extended engagement in a close-in environment. Of course, as that AK begins to heat up, it's going to string like crazy. The handguards do get very hot on an AK, as they do on an M16. But there's a lot of metal hanging off of that AK, and that stuff gets really hot. So that's a consideration.
I would say the Achilles heel, in my opinion, the Achilles heel to an AK not being as popular or even as conducive to a good weapon system to most people would be the way that the weapon is designed with the dust cover on top. You can't mount anything on there like optics or any type of pick rails because it's just going to bounce around. It's just the dust cover attached.
Yep.
So yes, it's a simple design, but the fact that you have to go out and you have to get a specific mount that kind of hugs over the top of the dust cover, but now you can't open your dust cover as easy because you have a mount blocking it. So you have to remove the mount to take the dust cover off.
Yeah. And then is your zero really going to return to zero?
So, I mean, these are all things that you have to take that, you know, when I look at, I told you like, a while back, I was like, man, I really want to build an AK. And as I started going down this rabbit hole, I'm like, this is crazy. Like, I'm so used to like the M16 or AR style rifles. It's so easy to work with. You have a flat top. You can just mount the optic on there. There's no moving parts like a piston going, unless you have a piston driven gun. But I mean, the DI guns, you know, you don't have to worry about it beating the optic up. You don't have to worry about removing any pieces to get the charging handle or the bolt out. And it's just so much easier to set the gun up without having to buy all these specialized parts. It's like, you have a cantilever mount. Great. Put the cantilever mount on there. I want a four rail, you know, handguard. Great. Literally pull the ring down, unscrew it, boom, handguards come off, put them on. It's so simple. No, can you do that with an AK? No. You need all these special tools. You need all these special mounts. And I guess I get it. Some people are like, oh, it's part of the ownership of an AK. You have to love it. Like, dude, I don't want to love it that much. I want to love to shoot it.
You know, so I think that there's a few things to consider here. One is that nobody can really argue that the AR-15, let's just say the Stoner design is considerably easier to work on, not only in the field for maintenance in a quick environment, just to be able to get her going again and get it back up in the field and get it running again in the field. All right, so say that you had that same barrel obstruction with a Stoner design that you had in the AK. All right, your barrel on the AK goose egged or whatever. Well, that gun's done. That's it. Right.
Yep. New rifle.
On the Stoner design, you can swap the barrel.
Or the upper.
Yeah. Or just change out another upper and it's easy. So it is from a standpoint of being an armorer in the field or just being a Joe Blow like you or I that needs to work on it on our own to get ready for a hog hunt or a coyote hunt or to get ready for defending our home or whatever we need to do with that tool. It is much easier for the end user to do any work that they need to do on the gun on a Stoner design than it is a Kalashnikov design. Now, when you get into the AK, okay, you mentioned the top rail. Texas Weapon Systems makes a hinged dust cover assembly for the Kalashnikov series of guns, and they hold up pretty freaking good, all right? And you can pop the dust cover open, and the optic stays on there.
Right.
You know, and you look at the crinks, some of those crinks, the modern crinks, are set up that way as well. So that's kind of cool. So it's not that people haven't made some attempt with the AK to modernize it a bit. I will say this. There are so many different specs of AKs.
Yeah.
Different countries of origin, different part specs. So it becomes very difficult to go, all right, well, my gas tube assembly on my AK crapped out on me. What do I do? How do I fix this? Well, all right, what country did it come from? Is it Romanian? Is it Chinese? Bulgarian? Is it Russian? Is it Bulgarian?
Yeah.
Is it Ukrainian? Where is it from? You know? Yeah, is it Yugoslavian? Is it, you know, where did it come from? Is it East German? Is it Polish?
Yeah.
Whose AK is it? And all of that's going to dictate whether or not that part fits.
Yep. Do you have the money Russian version? Like, yeah. It's like the real deal?
And then even if you do find the right part, it's going to require a little bit of fitting. So there's always going to be a little hammering, a little filing involved to change out a part on an AK. So they do require a little bit more patience. It's not the instant gratification of just popping on a rail system or changing a stock or just loosening to or hitting a throw lever on an AR optic and going boop and popping on something else.
Don't even get you started, Eric, on changing the trigger group on it. I mean, it's it's a different animal, you know.
I have some tricks that I employ for messing with trigger groups on an AK. You need hair bungees.
Yeah. Well, you just it takes a lot of you know, like this, to go back what I was talking about, like, it's just one of those things where, like, I don't want to deal with that, man. I don't want to have to do it. And I think the AR platform is so much more simple. It makes it very easy to work on for the novice, I'm not even going to say novice gunsmith, but the novice, like, guy that wants to just enjoy shooting, doesn't want to have to spend 20 hours, you know, and trying to go down this Google rabbit hole of how do I install a trigger group? I just deadlined my gun because I didn't know what I was doing and I lost a little spring. And now I have to wait, you know, 4 weeks for a spring to come in, you know?
It took me 5 hours to do the work on my Vepr that it would take me an hour to do on an AR. Mm-hmm. So that just puts that in perspective. It's not that you can't do the work and modernize an AK. It does require a little more care. And I will say this also, let's talk about suppressing them, okay? I love shooting various firearms suppress. AKs do not suppress nearly as well as ARs do. ARs with their direct gas impingement, they're very smooth, and they suppress quite well. And there are a lot of options for taking your stoner design and really tuning in that gas. I mean, there's gas buster charging handles. There's a superlative arms adjustable gas block where you can really just dial in that gas just right. All right, you can experiment with different buffer weights, different spring powers and spring types and hammer springs and every manner of gadget to dial that gun in exactly in the way you want. Suppressing an AK? All right, well, if the threads are concentric to the bore, and if a suppressor alignment rod doesn't go against the edge of the suppressor when you drop a can on it with the muzzle device, you're still going to have that loud action, that they're loud, and you get a lot of piston pop. Mm-hmm. So once that piston begins to move to the rear, once it clears the gas port, you're going to hear some noise, and that's called piston pop. Some people in the suppressor world will say first round pop, but it's piston pop. Mm-hmm. Whereby on a direct gas impingement gun, think about it. The gases are traveling that whole way through the entire system. So it's not like you've got a piston that clears a gas port and then now there's gas bleeding out of that gas port, you know, immediately.
Right.
So AKs don't suppress well by virtue of the way they're designed, not to say that the round, you know, not to say you can't suppress them, they just don't suppress as well. Now, there are some aftermarket gas blocks and some after, I know Chase at the Definitive Arms has an adjustable gas block for the AK series that he's made that helps alleviate some of those issues and help make the AK suppress a lot better. So there are ways to do it. But it's just a little bit more kind of...
I'm seeing a theme here where, like, if you want a good AK, it's going to take a lot of time to get it done the way that you want it and a lot of tools. And I would say it's like a lifestyle.
You have to really want one.
Yeah, you have to really, really want one. But what I will tell you is there is no replacement for seeing a really, really cool AK with a suppressor on it. Like, they just look...
Well, you shot one earlier.
Oh, yeah, they look... bad, man. I mean, I love it. Like, when you see it, it's like, oh, I mean, it looks way, yeah, it looks way cooler than like a standard M4 M16 with this with the suppressor on it. You're just like, oh, that looks cool.
Yeah.
And I mean, for all intents and
purposes,
there
is a sex appeal, yes, of modernized AK.
There is. I mean, it looks really cool. And I mean, even like the little
little things that go around the AK, the mounts for the optics, even those look cool. Like when you see them, like the way that they're bird caged out and they're like got lightning cuts on it. So you're like, dang, that looks sick. Like it just looks good. So I think for all intents and purposes, like we've done a really good job of kind of pitting these two, like the pros and the cons. We haven't really gone over any cons of the M16 or AR platform.
Okay.
So we've kind of beat up on the AK a little bit. I get it. And the AK guys at home, you're like, hey man, you're totally skipping over the cons of the M16. Well, okay, here we go. We're about to do it.
There are some cons. They do need to be kept clean.
Yeah.
I mean, now, look, there are probably people out there. I'm not going to mention any of them by name because I know some of these people, and I don't want them calling me up and be like, dude, what the heck, you called me out? And we're talking famous people, so I'm not going to get there. But let's just say a DIAR can't go forever without being clean. I mean, there's some people like, oh, well, I shoot mine 2,000 rounds and don't clean it. Okay, cool. That's fine. If you're going to trust – if it's something you're going to depend on your life, you know, you're going to protect your life with it, keep it clean.
Yeah.
They do require a little bit more maintenance. And, you know, there are more things that can inherently go wrong overall. You know, an AR is a relatively precise firearm. Like if those gas rings get out of alignment, you can start getting some short shucking and it may not run. And guess what? The only way to alleviate that, you have to pull that bolt apart and fix those gas rings. Now, of course, there's ways to fix that. One is the continuous gas rings that CMMG sells. And it's one continuous gas ring, then you don't have that problem. But in the original design, there are some inherent weaknesses that, you know, can happen. Cam pins do break. Extractors do break. One could argue the extractor on the AK is very robust and very large and very powerful. And yes, extractors break on AKs, but not as often as ARs, right? ARs do break extractors.
We should totally get Rob from AK Operators Union on here to he'd give you guys a really good rundown on the pros.
Rob can tell you what goes wrong with an AK because he's discovered every little tiny thing. But the AR is not without its quirks and issues. It does require some care. You need to keep them clean. Now, one awesome thing I want to talk about also, or where we marry some of these concepts, right? We look at the MK47 from CMMG as arguably one of my favorite guns. All right, now we have a marriage of some components. So we have a DI system, but now we have 7.62x39, and it takes AK-47 magazines.
Yep.
In my opinion, that is where the rubber meets the road. If you want to shoot 7.62x39 and you just like the cartridge, the Mutant or MK-47 is certainly a way that you can accomplish that. But having the familiarity of the AR, and arguably, I think you're marrying some really crucial components there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one really awesome way to be able to get the best of both worlds and not have to compromise in either direction. So there are modern guns that have answered these questions already in a very direct way.
Yeah, and I think that, you know,
And they suppress well.
They do suppress well. For me, the cons for the AR platform is two things mainly. One, the caliber. I mean, we can sit here and say, hey, 5.56 and 2.23 gets the job done. But it's like sitting at the red light in your sports car that's light, fast, nimble, and then you have like this
a work truck.
Then you have like a Hellcat pull up next to you and you're like, oh well, I'm not that fast. You know, it's like it gets the job done, but then you have the Hellcat that pulls up. That's like when you go to the range, you have your AR and you're like pew 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 pew, and then you hear the AK, you hear the Mutant running next door to you. It's like, and you're just like, all right, I'm going home, you know.
Well, to be fair, all right, with the Stoner design being so incredibly modular, if you don't like the caliber, just change it.
This is true.
That's what's so cool about it.
This is true.
I mean, in the short action AR-15 platform, you are afforded a myriad of different options. 300 Blackout, 6mm ARC, 6mm AR, 6.5 Grendel, 224 Valkyrie, 350 Legend, I think, fits in a short action. You can even convert short actions with the Stern kits to 9mm, 22 long rifle. I mean, the possibilities are absolutely endless. So that's one of the staying power legacy type of concepts for the Stoner design, is its ability to truly be incredibly modular.
And that's what makes the weapon system so great. The second thing is that everybody has one. So that's kind of like why people build AKs. You don't build an AK, well, you might, but you don't really build the AK because like, oh, I really want an AK. It's because you don't want an AR. So it's like, hey, everybody has an AR. It's America's rifle. Like, yeah, that's what it is. And then you go to the range and you see this Gucci AK and you're like, that looks dope. And like,
you know, I will say this, that I believe it is important to kind of honor both designs a bit. I mean, mm-hmm. if you're a gun enthusiast, and let's say that you got your favorite, I don't know, Daniel Defense Mark 18 set up to the gills with a D-ball and an ACOG and a nice flashlight.
All that stuff is like an $8,000 gun.
And let's just say she's good to go, and that's your life and liberty, you know, they're coming for me rifle. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean you can't own a nice Palmetto State AK or a, you know, little Arsenal or a Kalashnikov USA. I mean, there's lots of US-made AKs that are fantastic. And that they're not going to break the bank. I love the PSA pistols.
Yeah.
Right? With the folding triangle braces. I mean, that's a great way to scratch the itch of owning a Kalashnikov variant without having to go broke. You can still have your fancy AR and still have a cool AK as well. And I think that AK, for the gun enthusiast, is a gun that, you know, every gun enthusiast needs to have at least one.
That's true.
Just kind of part of being a gun enthusiast.
Well, and if anything, that the price point, like PSA, it was for the longest time is kind of like that barrier to entry for a lot of stuff, whether it's ARs or even like the AK, I think it's the AKV, they call it.
Mm-hmm, the 9mm.
Yeah. I mean, lots of options, but just having one to get that familiarity with it, because it does take some practice, like rocking in those magazines, the charging handles. I mean, everything is different. Like, you know, and then you start getting into like different platforms that are kind of culminations of both. So you have like the Daewoo K2, where it's kind of like, it's like an AR, but with the charging handle on the opposite side, like an AK, or the SCAR, where you have the charging handle on the left. You start seeing all these different designs that took from both of these traditional well-known classic designs and kind of making their own thing, like the FAL, you know, stuff like that. So I think there's a lot of different cool weapon systems out there. You don't have to shoehorn yourself into being an AR guy or an AK guy, because ain't no one going to argue with you when you show up with the SA-58.
No.
One's going to argue with you when you show up with a K2 Daewoo or, you know, whatever.
Or a Tavor or a Tavor. An AUG.
Yes, those are all super cool guns.
Or Desert Tech, you know, Covert or something. I mean, there's tons of awesome guns out there. There's no reason to pigeonhole yourself. I will say, going back to Palmetto State Armory, one thing about those AKs, a lot of them do use FN-produced barrels, which are very high-quality barrels. So I think they started with their AKs getting into the, hey, we're going to, you know, make this lower barrier of entry so that people can own an AK. But I think what's kind of happened, especially like after Mac did all the testing on the AKV, they put the Mac bracket in there, they tweaked and got them just right. And now the AKV is arguably like one killer little gun. It's awesome, right?
Made in America.
So their AKs are actually, you know, pretty freaking good. You know, it's not just this is affordable, it's the barrier of entry. Now it's like they're actually making stuff that kind of rivals some of the higher end brands. Now, it's never going to be a Rifle Dynamics. Big shout out, Jim Fuller. All right. Look, man, Jim is the man when it comes to AKs. You know, there's a few people in the AK world that I would point to and say, hey, if you want to know about AKs, these are people you need. Chase at Definitive Arms knows his way around AKs really well. Mm-hmm. Also, Jim Fuller obviously knows a ton about AKs. He's certainly your guy.
The godfather.
Himself. Oh, gosh, yeah.
Yep.
All right. Rob over at AK Operators Union. Yep. He's definitely a guy you want to look into on AKs. Also, our friends over at RS Regulate. His name is Scott. Scott over at RS Regulate makes arguably the best mounts for AK variants. He knows a lot about them, so he's a great resource as well. And plus, he just makes great products. And also, our friends at JMAC Customs that do all of the random mounts and things. So if you're trying to suppress an AK, they're the people to go through. They make the most suppressor mounts for AKs of anybody, as well as fore ends, stocks and rails and all kind of random assemblies. So The AK as a design, and I'm leaving out a lot of people because there's tons of people that do awesome work with the AKs. But the point I'm making, also Mark Krebs, Krebs Customs, great AKs, okay? But there are a lot of people out there that have an entire cottage industry that revolves around the AK. So the AK is not going anywhere as a design. Oh, and obviously, sure, it would go without saying, the list of people is 10 times as long for ARs, just because by virtue of there's so many of them out there and there's so many different variants, that the AR as a gun design and the stoner design has spawned an entire cottage industry. Yep. An entire gun industry that revolves around accessorizing and functionalizing the stoner design.
And new companies are popping up every day, which is great. I mean, you have a lot of new intuitive and ingenuity coming into the market. Things that, I mean, I saw one. It might sound kind of funny, but I saw one that was, Mr. Guns. He had those. It was so ridiculous, man. It was so short. There was no barrel. Like the tip of the bullet's like sticking out of the receiver. I was like, is that thing actually going to fire?
Well, it's not an SBR because it ain't got a barrel.
But see, that's like the ingenuity, like the stuff that's coming out. Like, is that practical? I don't know. Maybe. I don't know what the end result is. But the fact that you can take something that is, 60 years old and keep pushing forward with it and making upgrades and making different accessories for it and keep it fresh. If it's anything like the AK-47, I mean, we still have a long ways to go.
For AKs, also look at Polinaire Tactical. Yes. Those guys are awesome too. They run lots of AKs. So if you want AK content, that's definitely a great group of people to look into.
The original Slavs.
Yes, the Slavic squat boy. But anyway, I think this kind of dials in this particular podcast. I mean, look, the answer to this giant question is run what you want, honor both designs, understand that there are some areas that each design sort of spill over into each other, and we could do an entire episode just on hybrids.
That's right.
Between the two guns, because there's so many of them out there. I can't even talk about them in this video and this podcast because there's just so many. We don't have time.
Oh, we'll get into it eventually.
Yeah, maybe we'll do an entire episode on where those two things collide.
Non-AR or non-AK guns.
That's right. Something that's not one of those two. Yeah, I mean, and I think that speaks volumes for what each design has done to solidify itself in the gun world, right?
Agreed.
I mean, they're so famous for a reason, and they've stayed around for a reason. And I think it speaks volumes for the ingenuity and respect that you have to, you have to have respect for the ingenuity of the men that designed the guns, the conflict they were used in, ultimately. The men and women that have lost their lives and saved their lives with the guns on both sides of the aisle. No matter, I understand, some people are our enemy. We were their enemy. But at the end of the day, there were people out there that trusted their life to those respective gun designs. And when you remove the political environment of warfare and what, I understand, people are our enemy or whatever. But at the end of the day, you have to respect that people trust their lives to those guns. And for good reason, right?
That's right.
You have to at least respect it from an engineering standpoint and go, you know what? It's got to be good. Does this person, trust their life to it? So it's really interesting.
I agree.
I would say my vote goes for the AR, though. I'm a stoner man myself.
I'm with you, man. I am totally on team stoner. I mean, I love an AK. Like I said, they look sick when they're all Gucci'd out, but just from a practicality standpoint, got to go with Team Stoner.
Yeah, I'm on Team Stoner myself. All right, well, what team are you on? Let us know in the comment section below. Are you an AK or an AR kind of person? We want to know. And is there something we left out about, maybe some of the design aspects, or, did we leave out a reason that we should love or hate either of the guns? Let us know in the comment section below. Go over to Ballistic Inc. and pick yourself up a snazzy t-shirt. That's one way that you can support our podcast and or our YouTube channel here on Iraq Veteran 8888. Also, the snazzy hat he's wearing you can pick up. So we've got hats and hoodies and sweatshirts and all kind of good stuff and t-shirts and all sort of fun merch that you can buy to send to your favorite people for Christmas. That's coming up. Get your orders in before too long because we're not going to be able to ship in time with all the shipping crap going on. So get your orders in. And a big thank you to all of our Patreon supporters, those of you who purchased t-shirts, y'all rock. So have yourself a great week. Argue amongst yourselves. Maybe we'll revisit this video or podcast here at a later time. Definitely give us a great rating on all the different podcast servers. It helps us show up in the search results a little bit better. Also, if you're watching here on YouTube, give us a like, subscribe, click that notification bell, and make sure you leave us a nice comment down below. Let us know what you think. Many more on the way. Y'all have a great week. And I'm going to go clean my stoner.
That's right. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to Life, Liberty, and Pursuit. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere else podcasts are found. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review. We'd really appreciate that. You can support us over on Ballistic Inc. by picking yourself up some merch. And remember, guys, dangerous freedom. Have a good one.